Go ahead.
Welcome back to As the Story Grows. I'm sorry. Welcome back to the next chapter of As the Story Grows. That's what sucks about having a tagline. You just screw it up all the time.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Man, being realistic.
As the story grows.
Welcome back to the next chapter of As the Story Grows. My name is Trav. With me is my cousin and my co-host, Steven.
I'm going to talk slowly also to make sure I don't mess this up.
Notice anything different about me?
Did right you lose there? Weight? Oh, you got a hole in your tooth?
Did you get a
root canal?
I got up my root canal, that necrotic tooth that I had that was dying in front of my head.
Is there a hole right there now, or did they fill it?
Mm-mm. It's a dead tooth. My tooth is done. But they actually did a root canal. They cut out all the nerve ending and all the necrotic blood and dead shit that I don't need. And then they actually drill a hole. Check this out. They bleach your tooth from the inside to get it back to normal color. So they drill a hole up around the back of my tooth because it's a canine. It's one right up front next to my front tooth. They drill it, put a bleach tablet inside of it. I have a bleach tablet washing the inside of my tooth right now. And then
me too, but it's not in my tooth.
What? Are you sucking on a bleach tablet?
No, that was a bleached butthole joke, but because that's what people get done, like rich ladies. But anyway.
No one was talking. Oh, whew, man, you derailed that story.
Sorry. So you got bleach in your tooth. Can you taste it?
No, of course I can't. No. January 4th, they're going to go drill this thing back out. Yeah, I have a temporary filling, and they're going to pull the filling out, pull the bleach tablet out, fill it. Good to go. And now my tooth isn't as dark as it was.
This is the second intro we've done in a row where we've just talked about our health problems. And strange
health problem. I have a bad tooth. I'm getting it fixed. No big deal.
No, it's kind of a health problem, right?
Well, I guess. I mean, I hear all these stories about how people got root canals because they smashed their teeth on a merry-go-round, or broke it in a car accident or something. My tooth just started turning brown. Not horrible chocolate, milk chocolate brown. Mm. All of a sudden went a different shade. And I was like, what is going on with this tooth? He said, your tooth is dead. Why? He goes, I don't know. You could have did it 10 minutes ago.
No,
you
could have
did it 15 years ago. Oh.
Yeah, I've had 4 root canals, so I've had that happen to me before where the nerves died in it or whatever. And yeah, I need to. One day I'd like to get teeth back where the holes are, but oh well. What are you gonna do, right?
You're the one always talking about health problems. You are falling apart.
Oh, yeah, I am. It sucks. But 2016 is gonna be a good year because
it has to be. Because
if it doesn't, then there won't be a 2017.
If
so
it doesn't
there you go.
Better for you in 2016, you'll be dead by 2017.
Yeah.
Anyway, you have
a lot of changes.
You have a vinyl story.
I do. Yeah.
I want to hear it. Go.
So last time we talked about vinyl, I tried to outstage you with your getting free rare vinyl from one of our wonderful listeners. And I got that Polvo record. That was one of 5 coveted albums. One of the most coveted being Vengeance Rising, Human Sacrifice. Or as it was called at the time of its release, just Vengeance. Because that's the thing, is like the real copies, the original. Yeah, the original copies are Vengeance, no Rising.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, I've searched for that record for years on vinyl, and I've run it. I've found it on vinyl several times, but the problem was they were $200. Yeah, they were. Exactly. Yeah, but I just, you know, lo and behold, I get this Polvo record. I get it $40, which is a steal for how much it's worth. And like a day later from the last time we talked about this, I go back on Discogs. Some dude selling Human Sacrifice for $50.
I got it.
Yeah. I got me a Human Sacrifice vinyl with the art.
Unbelievable.
And that was basically my Christmas present for the year. So yeah, I'm officially now I have a couple more to do, but that's good for now. I'm done spending lots of money on vinyl.
Yourself a merry little vengeance.
Yeah, I knew you were gonna say that. Hey, you know, speaking of classic, influential, I mean, the ones that broke the door open for me.
Segway
drop. Yeah, that was a segue drop. We're going to be talking to a legend tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because see, a lot of guys will you know, their metal beginnings that were blossomed by falling, you know, they found Master of Puppets and Slayer, Reign in Blood. That was like their intro, you know, the big 4, Megadeth and all that. For me, growing up in a Christian home, I wasn't able to get those tapes in the 80s.
But I was far from me.
Exactly, yeah. But I was, my big metal beginnings was Stryper. And right after Stryper, it was Vengeance Rising, Human Sacrifice. And right around that same time, I discovered the band Deliverance, and they had a record out called Weapons of Our Warfare.
Yeah.
And in my honest to God belief about that record is it's as good and it's as legitimate of a metal record as those classic metal records. They may not have been associated in that group, but to me, that's what opened it for me and helped me to find those other bands. So tonight, to be able to talk to Jimmy Brown, Jimmy P. Brown II, as he's is a huge thing. I mean, he's a big influence on my metal beginnings. And the dude it's kind of a mess talking about Deliverance because I could call him Jimmy P. Brown II, the metal guy, or I could say Jimmy Brown, the goth rocker, Jimmy Brown, the prog rocker. The dude has so many weird influences and had the balls to release records with various projects sounds under that name Deliverance.
Let's get to it.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about all that crap. So
we should get over and start talking to Jimmy, or else we're gonna have no time to
say to him. All right, let's go. Let's go give Jimmy a phone call.
Hello.
How you doing, man?
Very good. I'm Travis, man. Nice to meet you.
Hi, Travis. Jimmy Brown. It's a pleasure to meet you, man.
Steven...
I'm the unmasked. I try to salvage the internet.
He doesn't have his camera on, usually.
No worries.
Look at all that stuff in back of you. My goodness.
You're actually here at Three Frog Studio. This is the studio I own with and operate with a partner of mine here in Alabama.
Nice.
That's sweet. I saw some stuff on Facebook you posted of it. It looks really awesome.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we've been working really, really hard on it, and it's pretty cool. It's different in the sense that. I never saw myself operating a commercial recording studio. I've been doing home stuff for so long, and to actually come into a professional thing, it was it's really cool. You know, I dig it. I mean, I got to work in pro studios all the time with Deliverance, but you know, there were other people running it. You know, I was just there as an artist. So
yeah.
Are you getting more business because Jimmy Brown Deliverance, or is it like just a regular advertising word of mouth Alabama thing?
You know, I get a lot of calls because of the Deliverance thing, and the Jupiter 6 thing, which is really
cool. We know because you're on one right now.
But I'm not getting business from that because, well, most of the people are from out of state, and they call. They're like, they talk to me, you know, because my cell phone's the number there, and they just call and they chat and they want to talk about Deliverance or this or that or the other. But when they ask about rates, I give them the rates and I tell them, well, I'll make you a package. But you know, most of them are out of state and they're not going to really travel that far, and of course everybody wants a record deal, and it's like, well, the owner has kind of a label, but not really. I mean, we have a Three Frogs Records, but it's not, you know, the age and days of labels are kind of gone, you know, with the, you know, unless you've just got endless financing, but it doesn't exist anymore, you know. Not,
I kind of feel like the only people benefiting from it are the ones who were already in it before it all started to, like, taper off and get weird. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, dude, you even look at, like, big acts. I mean, when Madonna released her last record, I think it was earlier this year, and, you know, I get the ASCAP newsletter, like, every day.
Okay.
And they said that, you know, this is a woman who is selling, you know, or was selling 10, 15 million records every time she put something out. And her last album got under 100,000 downloads, but yet there, but every time she packs a stadium at 300 to 500 a seat, it's packed. And it's like, well, yeah. Wait a minute. There's only 100,000 people buying her record, but there's, you know, hundreds of thousands at her concerts. You know, it's like,
yeah.
It's bizarre, and it shows, but well, part of it is just the, you know, anybody can get a record for free nowadays.
Yeah.
And, I just put out the Jupiter 6 movable walls last year, and dude, it was dismal. We you know, I put it out through my buddy Rocks Records. You know, Bill Rocks, and Rocks
been doing
stuff for years, and you know, I've worked with him for years. And so he said, you want me to put it out for you? Because, you know, I said, yeah, that might as well, because, you know, I don't know how to do it. And we put it out, and in 3 months' time, we sold, like, 190 copies. And I'm like, wow, do people just really hate this stuff or whatever? And but then a friend of mine who lives in St. Louis, Rick Mester, you know, he was in love with the record, and then I had another buddy who I actually, you know, he's kind of a hacker, and I told him, hey, do me a favor, put up a torrent, you know, and put it up free of charge for anybody to download, and just put high-quality torrent Jupiter 6 movable walls. Within 48 hours, he had 9,000 downloads.
No way.
Yeah, from independent IP addresses, and then the best, this is the best part. I get a guy sends me a link and says, "Is this you?" And it's a link for a site out in a South American country. It might have been Chile.
Okay.
And they had the movable wall CD, a bumper sticker, and a t-shirt for $25. Now, I have to admit, I became interested, and so I tried to place an order because I don't have a Jupiter 6 t-shirt, and I don't have a Jupiter 6 bumper sticker. So, and I don't make them, so I gotta jump on this. Actually, no, it was Peru. And
Oh my word, that is so crazy.
Well, I went to order it, and it says, does not ship to the United States.
Oh, so, come on.
And it's like,
of course it doesn't.
Well, this guy's smart, though. Whoever's doing it, because he knows the minute he does, he's committed a federal law, you know, or he's federal law and of copyright infringement. So
unreal.
Just tells it there in South America. So it's funny, you know, Deliverance played in South America in, I think, 2006 or 2007, and in support of As Above. And I got a call from the promoter, and he said, hey, we want to bring Jupiter 6 out here. I'm like, why? I mean, because I'm thinking to myself.
They're all wearing your shirts, man.
I've sold 90 copies. Why do you want to bring Jupiter 6 out there? And he's like, oh, dude, he goes, this will be bigger than Deliverance. He goes, your record's doing great out here. And I go, it is?
It's the third biggest bumper sticker in Peru, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Unbelievable.
That's crazy.
So they're just, they're selling it, they're bootlegging it there.
Oh, yeah.
And it's selling there, but not your copies.
Well, yeah, when we played, I'll never forget, we played a concert out in Puerto Rico. And people were bringing, you know, my first, second, third album, and you know, I'm signing, you know, and I'm like looking at them. I'm like, I don't remember these prints. I don't remember any of these prints.
Oh no!
They were all bootlegs. You know, they were like on Pancho Villa Records or something. You know, they weren't even on Frontline Intense Records. So
this is crazy. There's no map anymore, man. There's no. Yeah. Everybody has an insane, like, every person we bring on here that has actually done anything in the industry. Every story is just as insane, just as crazy. They're all different. It's gross what's going on, but there's no control in it anymore.
Well, yeah. The only way to do it, the only way to make any money, really, is, and everybody, you know, it's the industry standard now, is touring.
That's the
only way you can do it, because that's the only way. You can't make money on record sales anymore.
Right.
You have to rely on getting out there, touring, playing, and charging astronomical fees. I mean, whoever heard of Well, you know, my daughter, she's a metalhead, and we wanted to go see Slayer about 6-7 months ago. So we just moved back to Alabama about 5 months ago. So it was about, it was more like 8 or 9 months ago. We were back in California, and Slayer was playing. And I said, yeah, I'll get us some tickets, and me and you will go to the show. And then she said, oh, my buddy wants to go, and my boyfriend wants to go, and everything. And so I ended up having to go get 6 tickets. Well, it's no big deal.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no.
Until I saw the price. It was $125 a head, and I'm like, no chance, man. Well, who would have ever thought to pay $125 to go see Slayer?
I saw them 15 years ago, about, and it was about $15-$20 maybe. Oh, that was with surcharges and stuff.
If that. I remember seeing them live for the Rain and Blood tour back in 86.
What? You saw that? Oh my gosh.
And I paid amazing. I paid $8, you know?
Oh my gosh.
Right.
That is, I'm so jealous you can even have that memory, man. That's awesome.
Oh dude, I actually roadied for them when I was, 12 or 13. Oh, yeah, because Dave Lombardo went to the same high school as my sister. And okay. I was in junior high at that time, but he was in class with them. And so they used to play a lot with a band called, what were they called? They were some dorky band. But not Striper, because it wasn't Striper. It was like something like that. It was something. It was some weird name, and they were like a total glam rock band. And Slayer used to open for them, and it was hilarious. But Slayer used to do like Iron Maiden covers and Black Sabbath covers.
Wow.
They were a dorky high school band, but it was all the same members. I remember I accidentally dropped Kerry King's guitar, and they said, "Who is this kid? Get him out of here!" You know, I remember that. You know, because they used to play at the Southgate Municipal Auditorium, which was like I used to walk there in 5 minutes from my house growing up.
That's the day Kerry's hair started falling out, right?
Yeah. I don't know, man. It's just it was cool, but to be able to be around, and then I think 4 or 5 months later they got picked up by Brian Slagle over at Metal Blade and
right on. This is like the beginnings of Slayer. 82.
Yeah, 82.
Oh
82.
My gosh. How old were you then, if you don't mind me asking?
No, I was 12, 13 years old. You know?
Oh, my word.
Yeah.
I can't imagine, man. That's so rad.
Oh,
an amazing Metallica story. You got it. I don't know if you're open to talking about it, but I heard you say it on the Frontline Rewind. I think you were saying something about meeting James Hetfield and hating his record.
What made that funny was it was a college and career day at Bellflower High School, and his sister was doing hair there, and my hair had barely started growing out around then, but I thought his sister was kind of cute, so went and sat, got my hair cut, and I just told her just trim it, and she goes, "So your hair's long? Are you in a band?" And I go, "No, but I'm wanting to start one." You know, I was 14, maybe going on 15, and we just, talked, and then she told me where she lived. We kind of did the hookup thing. You seem a lot older than you are, and, of course, I was doing everything I could to hit on her. hang out on the front porch with her. I drive my little scooter because I had a little Honda Elite that I drove around, and I drive over there and hanging out in the front porch, and, her brother pulls up because I said, "What's the name of your brother's band?" And she says, "Metallica." And I said, "Oh, never heard of them." Cause I'd never heard of them.
Right.
And, they had just released Kill 'Em All, and they still, they were playing, but he still worked. He still worked a job, and the guys worked a job, and, he came home in a grumpy mood, and, here's this dude, this punk kid with his sister or whatever. And she tried to tell him, "Oh, he's in a band," and he just walks in. He ended up giving me the Kill 'Em All record, and I said thanks. And I didn't mean this disrespectful. I actually meant it when I said it. I said, would you mind autographing it and signing it? He said, why? And I said, you might be famous someday. And so he said, yeah, what's your name? And I said, Jimmy. So he put to Jimmy, he said to Jimmy, you know, keep thrashing or something like that. And he wrote his name. And so I take it home and I put it on. Now, you got to understand something. At this point, I'm like, I am so into melodic music, and I'm barely really and this sounds really weird for me, but I don't listen to metal. I really genuinely don't.
Yeah,
I like going to the shows, and I write it well, and I love playing it. The aggression is insane.
Right,
but
right.
When I listen, like, to music, it's commonly, you know, especially back then in those days, you know, 12, 13 years old, junior high, you know, everybody's listening to Mob Rules and Number of the Beast. And I did listen to some metal, you know, but it had to be melodic. It had to be guys like Bruce Dickinson singing.
Right on.
Right on, yeah. So
when I hear, you know, Hetfield, kill the lights, you know, or hit the lights or whatever, I was just like, oh, God, this sucks. So I got through the first song, Hit the Lights, and I was thinking to myself, God, these are like terrible Kiss ripoffs, and the guy can't sing, and, you know, the guitars are so cool. And I go, but I just, it's not Michael Sweet, it's not, you know, Matthias Jabs and the dude from, the singer from Klaus Main from the Scorpions, because that's what the metal I liked, you know,
right,
right.
Priest, Rob Halford. And so I take it off the turntable and I slip it back in. Well, right then my buddy from school, Jimmy Griffin, comes in, and he's like, hey, what are you doing? I'm like, whatever. And he's like, dude, you got Metallica? And I'm like, oh, you know, some girl, you know, that girl I met at school today, you know, the College of Career, that's her brother's band. Oh, no way. And he's like going on and on and on about it. And I'm like, I go, you like them? And he's like, oh, dude, they kick ass, blah, 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 blah. And I go, take it. I don't want it. And he's like,
oh, my God.
And he's like, oh, dude. And it's signed by him. It says to Jimmy, so it's, this is perfect. And he's got it to this day, from what I still understand. I haven't talked to Jimmy Griffin in probably 15 years, but even then, he still had it.
And you can't even say it's personalized to you because you guys have the same name. That's
exactly.
The funny, like, last kick in the balls about this story is just that
Totally. That's what's funny.
I gotta start hanging out with more dudes named Travis. They're gonna be hard to find, though.
Yeah. What's hilarious is, is the next year, you know, Ride the Lightning came out,
right?
And I flipped. I went gaga over that record.
Sure.
And I couldn't believe it was the same band, you know. And you know, anybody that knows Metallica knows that from Kill 'Em All to Ride the Lightning was leaps and bounds.
Oh my God.
Especially guitar tone. I mean, their guitar tone just went from kind of crappy Marshall sounding to like huge, and sounded like they were using sandpaper for their picks, and they was just awesome, you know? And that's what got me into it. And plus, James's voice got a little more refined, and I started getting into heavier music back by then. I mean,
it's unbelievable.
It's kind of a funny story, and I really wish, and I tried to get the album back. And Jimmy Griffin roadied for us all the way up until, until the Weapons of Our Warfare tour. He did that tour, and then after that, he got married and, you know, had to live a normal life. But, he still had it, and I kept trying to get it off of him. You know, I was just like, oh, dude, you don't really want that. You hate Metallica. And he's like, no way, dude, it's mine.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So whatever happened with Hetfield's sister?
Nothing. Oh, okay. Yeah,
man, you just lost out on that whole deal.
Well, you know, the funny thing that happened with that is she thought, and this sounds terrible, but I guess she thought I was older and that I was just some flunko in the school, you know, and just the dorky kid that got left back four times. She thought I was older.
Right.
So, wow. You know, she's 18, and I'm like, you know, what, 13? Or no, I was 14 years old. So, you know, she, I could understand why she wouldn't want to hook up, you know?
Sure.
Right. Sure. Was that the last time you ever spoke to her or James?
Oh, yeah.
Kind of like the end of it?
Yeah, that was the beginning and the end of it, you know. I had heard that they came to our show, that Lars and James had come to our very first appearance in 1986 or 87 out in the south, in the Bay awesome. Area. And we played a place called the Omni. And Jimmy Arsenault, who was booking all the concerts, he was the lead singer and guitar player for a band called Soldier. And but he was booking all these shows, and he booked us this huge show out in like I said, in Oakland, California,
right?
Called the Omni. Mm-hmm. And he knew those guys, and he said he was going to invite them. Now, this is not confirmed, but I heard they were there, and I heard that Hetfield said that we'd be a lot better if we stopped ripping them off. And of course, that broke my heart.
Wow.
You know. But, you know, I can't be totally mad about it because he was right. I mean, my God, you listen to those first two records, dude, and it's like Metallica and Slayer riffs all over the place, man.
Definitely. But, you know, it's weird because it's like where you guys get kind of into the Slayer speed of things, you still maintain that melody, though. You know?
Yeah, well, because I can't growl and sing. I can't do any of that stuff. I've tried. I think What a Joke is the closest to me trying.
I was gonna say, yeah, it's a little more hardcore sounding in that yeah. one for sure.
And I've tried. I mean, I really, really have tried. I just don't have that kind of voice. And if I were to want to do that, I would definitely want to sound like Tom Araya or. Max Cavalera from Sepultura. You know?
I was just gonna drop their name too. Yep. Yeah,
they're
I love it.
So cool.
Yeah. So you were coming up on like aside from the melodic metal stuff, from the sounds of these later Deliverance, some of the middle stuff you did with Terry Taylor, I mean you must have been into like The Cure and all kinds of stuff. Bowie obviously is a big influence. Like what was that kind of your thing too?
Bowie was huge. Bowie's still huge to me. I mean, he's always going to be that guy that I will be the cliche guy if I ever get to meet him before he croaks. But I will be that cliche guy that goes up to him and tells him, "You'll never know what your music meant to me," and blah blah blah.
Right.
Blah,
yeah. Blah.
And that's why, A, I probably wouldn't want to meet him because I don't want to be that doofus, that 10 millionth guy that said that to him. But he was pinnacle in shaping what I wanted to do musically. In fact, I'll tell you, this is how it started, is my sister... in my house, it was crazy. I mean, there was four of us, and I was the baby. And I was 12 years from my oldest sister, 9 years from my brother, and 5 years from my other sister. So I was obviously the mistake. I came along a lot later, put it that way. So, but they tortured me. They did all sorts of crap with me. But, I mean, we did all sorts of stupid things to each other ever since I could remember. And... and it was always for money, you know, and, you know, would you, you know, play with the dog's turd for, you know, 25 cents or whatever, you know, just, so this one was,
did you do it?
My sister came to me and my oldest, and she said, "You're going to drink this entire glass." I mean, it was a huge glass, of prune juice.
Oh, no.
I was 6 years old, and she said, "Then I'll take you to Zody's." That was like the Target of our day, and she says, "I'm going to take you to Zody's and buy you whatever toy you want." And I said, "Okay." And so I drank it, and after several hours in the bathroom,
definitely,
she did take me to Zody's, and as we were heading towards the toy section, I saw Diamond Dogs. And it was there, it was brand new.
Nice.
And and it had the sticker on it, you know, new, on sale, $199. And wow, I went up, oh yeah, and I went up and I grabbed it, and I said, I want this. And she, and this was her exact words, it's so hilarious, she goes, I can't buy that, dad'll kill me, that guy's a fag.
Oh no.
Oh my God!
And I said,
old fashioned days.
Oh yeah. And I said, I really want this. And she goes, you don't even know what he sounds like. And I said, yes, I do. Charlie has, you know, that's my brother. And I go, Charlie has his album, one of his albums, but this is new. And so she said, okay, but you have to keep it hidden. You can't ever let dad know I bought it for you. And she bought me Diamond Dogs, and that album just was everything to me. Still is. I put it on. I still get goosebumps when I listen to that record. There's certain cuts on it that are just unbelievable.
You were six and went after a Bowie record?
Yeah. Yeah. That's, of all
that's unbelievable.
Well, we grew up in a very a musical household. Everybody just constantly listened. There was music always playing in our house. I mean, nonstop. And then my brother was in a band. And like I said, he's nine years my senior. And he started playing in bands when he was like 14. Mm. And so I was exposed to music real early, and then every Sunday they'd always give me the broomstick and the sunglasses, and I'd do my Elvis routine for everybody in the family, you know, and you know, because I loved Elvis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so yeah, it's kind of funny. It's like, wow, what a step, huh? You go from Elvis to Bowie, you know, but it literally was. It was from Elvis to Bowie.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a gap. There's something missing in between there somewhere.
So yeah, by the time I was a teen, dude, it was all about like Duran Duran and, you know, Bowie and The Cure and you know, I was into all the electronic music. I loved Kraftwerk. You know, I loved Neu. You know, a lot of the German bands, and you know, we had a really cool record shop in our town, and I used to love just going and exploring all the import section and just really cool stuff, you know. And then Joy Division came out, and what was the band who did A New Order, the Blue Monday, and you know, I just was so into that music, and I more than likely that probably would have been my first band venture, is doing a band like that. But what it was is synthesizers were so expensive, and I didn't play, but if I were wanting to, you know, you're talking the average synth back then was between $7,000 and $8,000. I mean, so you had to be a serious enthusiast to get that, and there was no way my dad was gonna buy me one of those. You know, I mean, that the price of a car back then.
Yeah, it was like new back then. People don't realize that wasn't, you know. That was kind of like the current thing back then.
Oh, yeah.
It was like,
I mean, now you go buy a trashy synthesizer for, you know,
right.
$500-$600, you know, but
it
was a different time, different era. And so when I learned to play guitar really early from my brother, and that's kind of a funny story too, how I learned was, he was in a band called Middle Earth, which I thought, great name.
That's awesome.
Yeah, Lord of the Rings, you know, very cool, you know. He was a Tolkien guy since then, and they had a rival band that they used to play with all the time, and high school bands, everybody's, you know, broke, and, you know, you're scraping together to buy whatever you can, and I guess the guitar player in the rival band saved all summer and worked all summer for his dad, River, and got a Les Paul.
Ooh,
and a Gibson Les Paul, and that was like the holy of holies. And so the jerks in my brother's band decided to steal it.
Oh, no way. Oh, man.
Well, they realized after they got it, it's like, what are we ever going to do with it? Because we play with them all the time. They're going to know we stole it. So
exactly.
While they decided what to do with it, they hid it under my bed. Well, it stayed there for years, and finally I just pulled it out and started teaching myself how to play, and then I asked my brother, it's okay that I'm playing this, right? And he totally had forgotten about the guitar being there, and he was like, I asked him if he would teach me how to actually play, and because I had taught myself some Kiss songs and some Neil Diamond and did Led Zeppelin, and you know, I taught myself whatever I could.
Okay, wait a minute. You started playing guitar because your brother's band stole a rival band's Les Paul and shoved it under your bed.
Yeah!
Jimmy, that is the coolest friggin' get started story I've ever heard. The kid slept over a Les Paul for years. People have busted their nuts
trying to buy one.
And Jimmy's had one under his bed next to all the dust bunnies and all the dumb shit that collects under your bed.
Wait till the dust settles and pull it out.
That's awful, isn't it?
One day you like dropped a ball back there and you were like, oh, what's this? Oh, it's one of the best guitars ever. That's crazy. What a
fun. That's so funny.
You want to even hear where it gets real bad?
Dude, of course
yes,
we do.
Yes, yes.
Go ahead.
Well, by the time I'm 12, I decide I don't like this old man looking guitar. And I take it to the music store and trade it in for two Hondo Flying Vs.
No! This and the Metallica story combined, it's just mind-blowing.
Regret. Because Jimmy walked in and said, I want that Flying V. And even the guy behind the counter was like, dude, you gotta at least let me give you two.
Oh yeah, that's what happened. Exactly what happened.
Oh my god,
he's like, I gotta give him something else.
Oh yeah, he totally what he's doing. Bad. Yeah, he was still jacking me, but he at least felt a little better by handing me two guitars for it. You know,
exactly. Oh, it's
I'm picturing Jimmy with a Flying V in each hand, and he walked out that door, and it went. That little bell, and the guy was like, well, that was a freebie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And you gotta figure, I'm 12, dumb, and I figure, I scored! I got two guitars!
I got two for one! Yeah, exactly.
I had no idea what I'd just given up, and number two, what pieces of junk I was taking home.
Oh. Yeah. That's so funny.
That's a great story.
Ridiculous. Oh, man.
That's awesome.
So then you learned. Well, what do you do with two guitars though? What did you do with the second one?
Well, this is the best part. I didn't even have an amplifier.
What the hell are you doing? You were left alone.
This is a mess.
You were left alone. You were left alone too often as a kid.
They didn't. Well, dude, I hid in my room.
Oh my word!
I was one of those kids, you know, that just hid in my room, and I read, and then when I picked up the guitar, I started. Like I said, I had to teach myself, and first thing I had to do was teach myself how to tune it, and I'm letting too much loose here, but I went to the local music store that was in our town, which was ran by this nice little old Italian couple, but they didn't sell crap, you know? Mm-hmm. And they were real mean to me whenever I went in there, and they had a pitchfork. It was called a pitch pipe. Uh-huh. And I said, what is this for? And they said, that's for learning to tune guitar. You put that down. And so when he yelled at me like that and he turned around, I swiped it.
That ought to teach him.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, you know, that ought to teach him for telling me to put it down, you know.
That's so awesome.
Stolen guitar, stolen.
Man, you had the coolest underneath the bed ever.
So when I did take the guitar out and start learning, I had to first tune it, you know.
Yeah.
Right. And I remembered, I stole that little thing from the Calvano Music, so let me go get that thing.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's how I tuned the guitar.
So good.
That's funny.
The worst part was when I started teaching myself Van Halen songs, I was teaching myself all wrong because I didn't know about different tunings. And, course, tunes a half step down. And I had no idea, so I'm teaching myself everything the wrong way. So when I finally figured out about half-step tuning, oh, my God, it made my world a lot easier.
That's so funny.
All his friends wanted to come out and hang out in his room, and he was like, No, it's full of stolen shit. You can't go in there.
Yeah, I know.
No one's allowed in my room.
That's great, man. Oh, man.
Well, so Deliverance got started because you're a criminal. Got it. Moving on.
That's kind of funny.
So great.
That's crazy.
Kind of like got all, you know, you're, how do you say this? You got, I don't want to say known mostly for Deliverance, but I guess it's probably true, yeah, right? That's like your, that's your main gig, right?
Absolutely.
As a metal musician, but it's like, and clearly with the some of the records you made, it's like it was just all this other stuff, music was begging to come out. It was like almost like the metal thing was like a phase, but that phase is what like really would put you on the map. It's almost like are you, do you feel like you're, do you feel like it was more of like a phase thing, or is metal like a tried and true part of everything you do? I mean,
well, you know, I can't help it. It's kind of, it's just the way I play. And, you know, I mean, when I started teaching myself, so, I mean, the first song I taught myself was Sugar Mountain from Neil Young. And then,
nice.
Then I learned, Black Diamond from Kiss, and then I taught myself Over the Hills and Far Away and the Crunge and you know the Bridge, mm-hmm, from Led Zeppelin. It, like I said, it was whatever tapes or A tracks that my brother would throw out, I would grab and I would order. So I taught myself stuff based on that. But it was 1978 was the pinnacle change, because he threw out a brand new A-track that he got, and it was Van Halen 1. And I had no idea what the effect that album was going to have on me, as with many other guitar players.
What do you mean he threw it out? What do you mean when you say he threw it out? Like, I listened to it, I don't like it, pitched it in the garbage?
Yeah, he just tossed it in the garbage. And
wow.
And we had a guest house, and that's where he lived, and I used to go hang out in the backyard by the guest house, and so I'd see his trash. And I'd rummage through it, you know, and then also he paid me, and this is terrible too, man. This is a hilarious story. And actually he didn't know I did this. Actually, I got everybody mad at me last year when I told everybody this story. So I got to tell you, it is kind of funny. You know, we had a dog, and the dog was like the best dog in the world. Her name was Pebbles, and she was with us for 17 years.
Uh-huh.
And good family mutt, you know. But my brother he had a cat, and the cat would poop all over his room, and so he started paying me 50 cents a week to clean the cat poop up.
50 cents.
And so,
what a rip.
Oh yeah, totally. Well, you got to figure this is the 70s, you know, but still
the inflation, yeah.
This was a terrible discovery, guys, but I let Pebbles in with me that day, and before I could get the newspaper to go pick up the poop, she ate it all.
Oh, no.
And not only ate
that,
it,
like, they do that?
Oh. Really well.
I already see where this is going. Now you're getting paid 50 cents to let Pebbles go eat all the cat crap.
Oh my gosh. That's awesome. What I need to do with my day job. I got to figure out a way. No.
You got to find your pebbles. That's what it
is. Exactly. I got to find my pebbles and make this work.
Yeah, but that's what I did. And it's so funny. They just
Man.
They were like all like grossed out and mad that I let, and I'm like, I didn't make the dog eat the shit. You know, I mean, it was.
Yeah, exactly. If he does it on his own, hey.
Yeah. So it was funny.
It's your stupid cat's fault.
Right. You know, cause my oldest sister, I mean, she should be the president of PETA or FETA or whatever any of those animal rights things are, because she just loves animals so much. So she called me an abuser. I'm like, I'm not an abuser. The dog was doing what was ever natural to her, I guess, you know.
Right.
Picking up cat shit for 50 cents is the abuse.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was what it was. It was kind of funny, but nonetheless, I emptied his trash. That's something Pebbles couldn't do. That's how I would discover all these great 8-tracks and stuff that he was throwing out.
Yeah. Why wouldn't your brother take the 8-tracks or the records back to the record store and trade it in for other stuff? Like, who throws music in the garbage?
Well, I think part of the reason, number one, they had a friend who worked for Casablanca at that time. Okay. And he would get a lot of free stuff, you know, a lot of stuff just handed to him.
Okay.
And that's how he got the first Kiss record, you know. I mean, he got the first Kiss record handed to him like that because, you know, they were on Casablanca and, you know, he used to just get him stuff all the time. So I think that's why he didn't pay for it. So that's
why it
didn't
matter to him. Okay. That makes sense. Wow, that's fun. I've bought stinkers before. I've bought albums that I didn't like. Then again, I didn't pay, I didn't pay 50 cents for them or whatever, but.
Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, yeah.
You know, threw him in the guard. Then again, you're buying Bowie vinyl for $1.99. My goodness gracious, that's
yeah. I'm revealing my age. That's for sure.
One of the things I'm dying to ask you, as a Deliverance fan, as I was buying these albums as they were coming out, and I'm noticing how completely, especially between Weapons and Stay, I'm just like, you know, back then I wasn't quite up to speed with the Daniel Amos thing, the Terry Taylor stuff. The only thing at the time I really knew was that he produced Sin Disease, and that was like another one of my huge favorite albums.
Oh yeah.
And yep. So like I'm listening to this transition, and I've always loved it, but because I was such a fan of different kinds of music, and it never really occurred to me that you were gonna piss fans off or you were gonna make them think you're, you know, completely abandoning your metal ways and all that stuff. But I have to know, how on earth did you even, how did that even come together where you go from Weapons of Our Warfare to working with Terry Taylor and Gene Eugene? I mean, I've come to really appreciate them now. Obviously, from Sin Disease and your stuff, it kind of opens me up to his bands, and then I got really into Daniel Amos and all that stuff. And now that I get kind of like, what that meant to do something like that, to get produced by Gene Eugene and all that, and Terry Taylor. It's just such a strange thing. Now that I'm on the other side of it and I know how, like, all the context, how on earth did that happen where you went from Weapons to Terry Taylor?
Well, you know, one of my very first concerts that I went to, you know, my brother converted to Christianity in 79.
Okay.
And he was going to Calvary Chapel Downey. Okay. And I was taken to Christian rock concerts all the time from that point on. You know, secular music became a big no-no in the house because the whole house converted with the exception of my father. And, and he didn't care. He was just like, if it keeps you off drugs, then it's fine with me. And that's the way he, you
know. Right.
But, you know, we went, and the only album I had from Daniel Amos was their first album, which was a country record.
Yeah, I have that one.
Oh, wow, okay.
And so,
it is so different.
And so I had seen on the bulletin board that Daniel Amos was playing that Saturday night, and this is 1980, and I tell my sister, oh, gosh, you got to take me to go see Daniel Amos. And she's like, oh, okay. And now, unbeknownst to me, she's still listening to Bowie and everything else. She was made to throw it all away, but she didn't. She kept it all in her car.
Right.
So she's like, okay, that's fine. And so we're driving on the way to the show, and I kid you not, I'm like sitting there saying, oh gosh, I hope they play Jesus is Jehovah to Me, and I hope they play, you know, Shocking Angel and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I'm all excited.
Yeah.
I'm thinking I'm going to go see this country band. And they rip out with I Love You number 19.
Nice, yeah.
And I went, oh my gosh, and they're doing this in a church? You know,
yeah, which back then that must have been pretty shocking.
Oh, it was. It was insane. I turn to my sister, I go, is this okay? And she goes, apparently it's fine. And dude, I just
went
haywire, man. I went absolutely haywire. And I just fell in love with everything Terry. Now,
yeah.
This is how I met Terry Taylor all these years later. It's 1989, and we have signed a deal. Actually, it was 88 when we signed with Intense Records.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Intense kept telling us, the owner of the company at that time was called, his name was Caesar Kalinowski, and Caesar just kept telling us, send us a new demo. We were signed, but he kept making us send demos.
Right.
And I mean, at this point I went out and I painted houses for a month to buy a four track. Cause I was like, well, I mean, our garage tapes aren't doing it for him, blah, 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 blah. And dude, now I'm sending him demo number 6, and he keeps criticizing them all. And I finally send him the worst recording of all, and he says, that was it. I love it. Let's book studio time. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is ridiculous. And
what was it? Just curious.
Well, I was just recording songs on...
Like
on,
from the self-titled
album. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So, well, the studio time never got booked. And I finally get a call from him, and he says, hey, I'm in L.A. And he lived in Chicago at the time, and we were supposed to fly to Chicago to record. And he goes, I need to meet with you. Do you have time? And I said, yeah, that sounds great. And so I'm all mad. I'm fired up. We've been signed for like 9 months, and we still have no idea what we're doing. And Vengeance's record had already come out. And you have to understand, even though Vengeance, the guys in Vengeance were our bros, they were actually our rival at the time because... We were out first, and Larry left us to start Vengeance Rising with Roger. Man. So
yes, I saw that on Wikipedia, and I learned an hour before we called you that Larry Farkas used to be in Deliverance, and I was like, "Whoa, I got to ask about that." I'm glad
he was our first guitar player, and we stole him from Holy Soldier because he used to be in Holy Soldier.
What?
Wow, I didn't even know Holy Soldier was going on back then.
Oh yeah, he played for Holy Soldier. And so did our drummer, Chris Hyde, rest in peace. Chris Hyde played for Holy Soldier, and he had told me...
This is the same Holy Soldier, like...
Yep, Last Train and all that other stuff.
Stranger, that one?
Yeah, uh-huh. Yep, same way.
Yeah, I had no idea they went back that far either. Holy
oh, yeah. Well, so when we were looking for another guitar player, you know, he said, hey, my buddy Larry plays in Holy Soldier. Let's go watch them play tonight, and then you can talk to him. So
Let's go steal him.
I'm sorry?
Let's go steal him.
Yeah, in essence, that's what was going on. Well, it was funny, too, because he didn't fit the band. He was not glam. He was all grody and 70s looking, and then the rest of the band were a bunch of pretty boys, you know? And so after the show, I approached Larry, and I said, hey, man, come out, listen to our demo. And I didn't drive at this time. I was 15. And so we went out to Chris's truck and popped a tape in. He listened to it. And Larry goes,
you guys don't need another guitar player. He goes, you're doing just fine on your own. And I said, no. I go, I hear harmonies, I hear melodies, I hear different things, and I really want to concentrate more on my singing, so I do need you. And he's like, why do you want me? And I go, because you're awesome, and you would fit us. And that was it. Larry joined us. And Larry was with us for a little over a year and a half, and then when we discovered thrash metal together, that changed everything. Mm-hmm. And Larry just got into it. I mean, he got really into it. And we started getting into the intricate picking with each other, and we were just challenging each other with writing and all sorts of crazy stuff. But he eventually wanted to go. And then there was also philosophical differences and religious differences, because he was part of a group called Sanctuary, which, mm-hmm. trust me when I say this, and I mean no disrespect, love Bob Beamon. Bob Beamon is a dear friend to me and to my wife and my family. Yeah. He always will be. But at that time, I was going to a hardcore Pentecostal church, and Sanctuary was off limits. Actually, everything I was doing was off limits, but Sanctuary was really off limits to us.
Sure, yeah.
And Larry was very hooked up into Sanctuary, and Vengeance Rising was, or at that time they were just called Vengeance. They were a Sanctuary band, and so there was a lot of pressure on Larry, too, to be part of more of a Sanctuary-connected thing, because Bob had asked us to be a part of the whole thing, but me and Chris were adamant, because me and Chris were the only tongue talkers in the band.
Wow. And,
yeah, different time.
Totally, yeah. So you guys...
That's what led to Larry departing and starting his own thing, and then we went on the endless quest for guitar players, because every guitar player that joined us from that point on, I felt so bad for them, because I just kept telling them, you're not Larry, get out. You're not Larry, get out. I mean, it was awful. I felt bad for all those guys. And then we landed Glenn Rogers, and me and Glenn got along famously, and that's Glenn stayed with us for a number of years, you know, mm-hmm. or a couple of years. But anyway, so we're here being strung along by Caesar. Getting back to that, I will tell you this: my conversations tend to go in huge circles, but I promise you, I always come back to the subject.
No worries, man.
I love hearing the stories, man. This is great.
Yeah.
Well, so I meet with Caesar, and I'm like, I'm all fired up. I was the baby of the band. Everybody else was in their 20s. I was 15 when I started. They were all 21, 22. I'm 15.
Unbelievable, so, man. Wow.
I'm the one who does the business. I'm the one who makes the calls. I write the music. You know, I mean, they let me just run the whole show.
Yeah. So I'm yelling at Caesar Kalinowski. I'm like, dude, we've been sending you demos for 9 months. We were supposed to be in the studio months ago. What's going on? Well, he finally tells me, look, I was broke. And I couldn't get you into the studio. The Vengeance album didn't do what I thought it was going to do. But there's a good thing. I sold the label. And I'm like, oh, crap, you know?
Oh, boy.
And he sold the label to Frontline Records.
Right.
So when he sold it to Frontline, he said, they're going to take care of you. They know that you're a priority. And they'll take care of you. So he took me to their offices out in Newport Beach, and I met them all, and they welcomed me very nicely, and I had to re-sign everything, and the first thing they said was, sure. Well, first off, who writes all the music? And I said, I do. And they said, okay, any of the other guys? And I said, no. I go, I just write everything, but, you know, we're a band, we play together. And they said, well, here, sign here. And I didn't know I was signing a 5-year agreement.
Oh,
it was kind of a nightmare, but I'm there signing the deal.
A 5-year, not a number of albums, a 5-year agreement.
Yeah, five album, 5-year agreement.
Oh, geez.
Okay. Wow, yeah. that's crazy.
Yeah.
So I'm there, and none other than I see Terry Taylor down the hallway.
Oh, man.
And I look and I go, is that Terry Scott Taylor? And they say, yeah, you know Terry Taylor? And I'm like, oh, dude, I'm a huge fan. And they're like, great, well, let's go introduce you. And so I'm like shaking in my boots. I'm like going over there and, you know, trying to fix my hair and trying to be cool. And Terry, the one thing about Terry, he's a big time introvert, and he's hard to get to know. He defines, or personifies eccentric. He's just so cool. I just love everything about Terry. But
oh yeah, absolutely.
So he turns around and he's hardly looking at me, and the vice president of the company, Mike McLean, says, "Hey, this is Jimmy Brown. He's in the band Deliverance. He's singer songwriter, and he's a big fan of your music." And he kind of looks at me and he goes, "What kind of music do they play?" He won't even address me. He goes, "They're a speed thrash metal band." And he goes, "And they like me." And I said, "No, they don't. I do."
That's so funny.
And then I go, "I just wanted to tell you, sir." And of course, I approached him as sir. And
this
I said,
great.
I just want to tell you, sir, your music has meant the world to me. I hold you up there with, you know, Brian Eno and David Bowie. You've just been such a huge influence on me, and I just wanted to tell you that." He looks at me and says, "How sad for you," and walked away.
No way! You're kidding me.
No, and walked away.
Oh, my God. Jeez. What is he? Was he depressed?
No, he just, that's Terry.
Oh, my word.
So,
that was that his way of being funny with you, or was that just like a, just didn't care?
I think it was just a little of both. I think Terry at that point was just kind of reaching a point in his career where, you know, he didn't know what he was doing, and at that point he started becoming more of a producer rather than an artist. And
yeah.
So things were changing.
Oh, man. Did you feel like totally bummed out after that? How'd that go for you?
I laughed. And I thought, you know, he has kind of a sick sense of humor like me. I think I'm going to like this guy. And that was exactly what Mike McLean had said to me about him. So, well, Ed McTaggart, who was the drummer for DA, was the art guy there.
Yeah, he worked at Frontline FC.
Yeah, and so Ed immediately comes over to me and says, "Don't mind Terry. He's just that kind of guy. He didn't mean anything by it." And I said, "No, I'm fine. I'm totally fine. But nice to meet you, dude. I'm like, this is so cool to meet you." And I got to work with him, and it was really neat. So now I, we're obviously a thrash metal band, so I'm not even seen working with Terry. But I started thinking, oh, solo project, you know, and I want to work with Terry. So, well, we record our first album. It does way more than Frontline ever thought it was going to sell. You know, they were hoping for about 15,000 units sold, and in the first quarter it did 40,000 units.
Wow! So
this is the self-titled Deliverance album.
Yeah, the first album, and they were blown away, and they were like,
"That's great.
You got to get on tour. You got to, you know." Now all of a sudden we're in the lifestyle. Things have changed.
Yeah.
It was really cool. Well, we did the first tour, and I'm a kid. I mean, I just got married, had a baby, and you know, it was hard to leave to go on the road for 9 weeks. And
how old are you at this point? How old are you?
18, 19 years old, around there.
Oh my gosh, married and a kid, 18 years old, and on tour.
Yeah.
Yeah. With a hit record and a going about to explode on the earth with the band. That's a lot.
And a stolen tuning fork.
So I come home and I end up meeting with the guys at the label, and now at this point, now I have to preface this part, is George came into the picture, and Glenn, unbeknownst to me, while we're recording our first album, has already joined a band out in Europe. And he didn't even tell me. The only one he had told was Brian Carrillo. Well, Brian, being the incredibly loyal and wonderful man that he is, told me. And so I told Glenn, "This sucks, but look at, dude, we're doing a record, and you know Bill Metoyer's in here, and we met Bill because of you, and you know why would you leave?" But he just felt it was his time to move on.
Yeah.
And that was cool, but me being 18 years old, you know, got all mad, and I rewrote all the parts he had written right there in the studio.
Wow.
And just so I couldn't give him, I didn't want to give him any credit for anything. I mean, I was just mad at him for, you know, because you got to understand, we had went through endless guitar players, and then finally we find the guy that replaced Larry, and then now he's leaving. So, well, this point, me and Roger Martinez are really good friends. And
oh, man, you can talk about this guy all you want. He's a white elephant to me. He's so enigmatic, I would love to hear his story.
Well, me and Rog are bros, and I, you know, and he tells me, hey, there's a guitar player I know, you know, he's kind of in a band that's on the rise right now, but he's actually interested in joining Deliverance. And I said, well, who? And he's like, well, I don't want to tell you. You know, if you know Roger, he's just a weirdo. And he ends up taking me to go see a band called
Steven,
Recon.
Steven, he's calling Roger a weirdo. And this is 1980 what?
This is 1989. Yeah.
Yeah. That's not even current weirdo status. Wow.
Oh, dude, I've known Roger since 1985 is when I met Roger. And I'll
wow,
tell you,
man.
I'll just say this about Roger. He hasn't changed. He's the same dude he's always been, trust me.
Really?
That's all I'm going
to
say.
Do you still talk to him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Oh, we're going to circle back around to that at the end.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he introduces me to George. Wow. Well, I already knew George. And, but George never remembered me. Every time I'd meet him, he'd never remember me. I don't know if he just had short-term memory loss, too much pot. I don't know. But he never remembered me. But I played him some cuts off the album. You know, I had some rough mixes on me, and George said, man, I'd love to, but, you know, he goes, I'm working on a deal with Pachyderm right now, and, you know, they're going to sign Recon. And I said, well, I go, be honest with you, dude, you do what you want. And I go, this band you're in right now, Recon, this is good music too. So, you know, whatever, you know, and I kind of just left it at that.
Yeah.
He called me 2 days later and said, I want in. And so we were in, and me and George became buds at that time. So George ended up doing the Victory Tour with us, the first tour.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
But when I came back, it was a little more than I'd hoped for, I guess. It was it was just different. I wasn't used to touring, and anybody that knows me, even though I'm a loud, love to laugh, love to BS, love to, you know, drink, mm-hmm. smoke with you and everything else, I'm a homebody. I'm one of these guys that just stays in one place, and it's hard to get me to go do anything. Any
yeah.
of my closest friends will tell you that.
I can relate
yeah,
to that.
Yeah, I totally relate with you on that.
And, I mean, I've been this way since I was a kid. My wife couldn't get me to even go to the movies, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've known her since I was 12, you know? I came home, I was depressed, I was just like, God, this sucks, and I just thought it was going to be a lot better, and then Brian and Chris weren't happy, and they were really tripped out, and then this was the worst part. I got my first royalty check, and
oh.
I get it, and it's like $7,800, and I'm like, wow, this is awesome.
Yeah,
and, bad for us. And I'm like, I can't believe this, $7,800, you know? And I'm like, so if I get this every, and I call the company and I go, and when do I get these checks? Is it once a year? Or they're like, no, once every 3 months. So I'm like, oh.
Jimmy called and went, you accidentally sent me $7,800. This can't be right.
Well, I'm like, if I can
wow, that's good money back then, though, for 3 months. Holy.
Well, yeah, I'm thinking if I could make $7,000 every 3 months, man, this beats working at Burger King, so I'm totally cool.
Hell yeah.
And
heck yeah, man. That's great.
Well,
you know, you want to know what's sad? You're talking about 1989. $7,000 every 3 months still beats working at Burger
yeah,
King.
Yeah, totally.
2015.
Well, this is so sad. I call the guys, and I tell them, man, did you guys get your royalty checks? And they're like, no.
Oh.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah.
I'm like,
you have to pay Deliverance.
Yeah, and I'm like, well, what do you mean? You guys haven't got them yet. And they're like, no, we haven't. And I'm not calling George because George had nothing to do with the first record, so I'm only calling Chris and Brian. I said, well, I'm sure it's on its way. And they said, did you get one? And I said, yeah. And they said, how much? And I said, it was all right.
$3,000?
A week passes, and they haven't gotten anything. Well, at this point, I've got two new guitars. You know, I bought my wife a legit ring, wedding ring. And you know, I've spent a lot of it. And
oh, because of that signing that you were talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I called the label, and I said, dude, I called the VP, and I'm like, dude, my guys, I mean, they haven't, like, gotten their royalties. And they said, do you not know how this works? And I said, no. And they said, who wrote the songs? And I said, you did. Or I said, I did. He goes, then you get the royalties. And he goes, they get artist royalties when the album's paid back. And let's see, your album cost, let's pull up the budget, $33,000 to make.
Wow.
And per record sold, you guys get around 60 cents. So when they have paid $32,000 back, then they start getting royalties. And I said, they get 60 cents a record and it's sold? And they said, yeah, that's artist royalties. You, however, are a writer. So you get a greater percentage. And I said, oh, and they said, but you're more than welcome to share yours with them if you want to, but you don't have to by law. Well, now that I've spent almost all of it, you know,
right.
I explained to them what's going on, and I apologize for not knowing. Then they're like, well, what happened to the contract we signed? And I said, well, that it's null and void. I had to sign a new agreement. And they said, why didn't you have them all of us sign? And I'm like, they just asked me if I wrote all the music. And I said, yeah. And now they're getting upset with me.
Yeah.
Brian was the most understanding. Chris, unfortunately, wasn't. And within, you know, months, Chris ended up just leaving. And then Brian ended up leaving.
Was it over that?
It was over that and touring. And Brian and Chris had been married and had kids already. And well, not kids, multiple each, but they had already had a kid each. And
yeah,
it was just getting hard all the way around. And George was single, or not single, he was married but no kids, and his wife had a good career, so he could leave no problem. And I was dedicated to this because it was my gig.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was a tough time, man. It was a tough time. And then so I wanted to meet with Terry and do a solo project. And well, Terry was unavailable, so they hooked me up with some guy who produced Donna Summer Records. His name was Scott Blackwell.
Oh, I know that name, though. He had some techno albums and stuff he was doing.
Yes, right? Yes.
Guy? Yeah, I remember him. Yeah.
And he, so I hook up with him, and
how do they do that? I want to do a solo album with Terry because he's one of my biggest influences. Well, he's not available. Here's another dude. Like, that doesn't, I really want a chicken sandwich. Sorry, Rod, here's beef. That doesn't, like, it's the wrong thing, right?
Well, it was the wrong fit, and the hilarious part was number one, the songs I had were terrible. They were just, I had three songs to demo up, and they were just terrible, terrible Bowie ripoffs. And
so State of Execution wasn't what you presented. For some reason.
No.
Oh, okay. I always thought that's how that went. Okay.
No, so I'm getting to that. And so
amazing.
I play all these. So I go and work with Scott Blackwell, and dude, this music was like, it was like a combination between really bad porn music, you know, the bounce, chicka, bow, bow, that kind of thing, and pop. It was just weird. And at this time, me and Glenn Rogers had made up, and he played guitar on it, and we were trying to make something of it, and it just didn't work, and the label listened to the demos and said, this is horrible. And they said, you know what, we'll get you hooked up with Terry soon enough. But I ended up meeting a band called 12th Tribe through Scott Blackwell, and I ended up
working. I used to like them.
Yeah, I ended up working on their records with them, and Scott produced them. So,
did you do anything with Knowledge is the Tree of Life?
Yeah, I actually they used a couple of samples, and I actually did a couple of things on them, and then I really worked heavily on the Babylon album, the second album. And
oh,
then,
okay. I'm not as familiar with that one, but I always wanted to hear it.
Yeah, yeah, I worked heavily on that one with them, and then I produced their third record, Return of the Heavyweights. I fully produced that one. And
wow, I didn't even know they did three records. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was a big fan of that first one they did, though. I dug that a lot.
The other ones were much better, but Knowledge was a pretty good record.
I'll have to hear them. Yeah.
So,
cool.
So, me and Scott, we stayed working with each other, and he would hire me to, like, play guitar tracks and stuff because he knew I liked playing funk guitar and stuff. So, but then Weapons came. And we recorded the Weapons album and then a video, and then we just had no idea that record was going to take off the way it did. I was obsessed with the book This Present Darkness from Frank Peretti.
Mm-hmm.
And
I wrote
it kind of all centered around that. And it was cool. I mean, it was really cool. But, you know, again, came back from the tour, kind of just bummed out. And now the big joke was we had become DeliverCon because now we had, you know, three quarters Recon and me Deliverance, you know. And because, you know, Brian and Chris gone, we hired Johnny Gonzalez, who was in Recon, and Mike Grotto, who was in Recon, you know. And by the time What a Joke came around, we were going to record the Hypocrisy record. That was the next big concept record I had been working on. And but George and I just were fighting like cats and dogs. And so, and part of it was he wanted to sign with Pachyderm. And Pachyderm was offering us a really good deal, but I had signed a 5-year, 5-record deal.
Hmm.
And so we were given the suggestion by, I will not say who, but to just create such a horrible record that they're going to throw you off the label.
That was a suggestion from someone, and you can't say who it was.
But. Yeah, and we did it.
Like, was it a friend you were sitting around having a beer talking about it, or was it someone within the label?
No, not our label. So
gotcha.
Well,
oh man, this is good.
It worked because the record label was pissed. They hated the album. It bombed. It didn't even sell, I think, like 27,000 units, I think it sold.
You put the ingredients of chip beef on there, Jimmy. What the hell did you expect?
Oh, I know.
Chip beef. Such a treat. One.
cups of whole milk, 1 tablespoon of cornstarch, 2 tablespoons of butter, half package of frozen peas, fresh if preferred, salt and pepper to your own taste. Hear the directions, follow closely. Fry beef in the butter in a medium saucepan. Add the milk, then the peas, then salt and pepper to taste. Mix cornstarch with 1/4 cup of whole milk. Then add mixture to simmer 10 minutes or so. Although the recipe calls for fried linguine, I prefer several layers of warm buttered toast, lightly toasted.
You intended to kind of make some waves, though, right? I mean, is that
We wanted it to be crappy. I was writing a lot of condescending lyrics at the time, and it was just an angry album, I think, in a lot of ways, and most of it was because
I love it though.
The infighting.
It's a fun thing.
Yeah.
What's that?
Well, the infighting between me and George led to a lot of that, you know.
Yeah.
And so they came to me and they said, "Yeah, we know about the whole, you know, trying to get thrown off the label bit." And I said, "Really?" And I go, "Well, I'm not going to lie to you. Yeah, that's exactly what we're doing." They said, "No, well, you're locked in for 2 more records. This is what we're going to do. We have only signed you. We've had enough of George's antics, and we've had enough of this, that, and the other things. So we're going to give you what you wanted in the original agreement, or originally what you've been bugging us for, and that's to work with Terry Taylor." And I said, "Well, cool, but for my solo project, right?" And this is the exact words of the VP. "Something like that." And I said, "Okay." So I start meeting with Terry. Okay? Now, I'm bringing Terry all those terrible Bowie ripoff songs of mine. And not the Scott Blackwell versions. I'm bringing them
mine. Oh, okay. I got you.
Because at this time now, I've got my little 8-track studio at home, and I'm recording demos left and right. So I bring them all to him, and he's listening to them, and he's like, "Well," he goes, "got a great voice," and blah 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 blah. And we've met like 3 times now. And like I said, he's very eccentric. He's very quiet, and then we end up sitting on the beach, and he's like, "So tell me about Deliverance. Tell me about this band of yours. And what is it how come you don't want to do it anymore?" And I told him, "Well, I kind of want to do like you did. You know, you did these solo records. I don't want to throw away Deliverance, but you did the Terry Scott Taylor records, you know, Knowledge and Innocence." And
oh, yeah, and those are great records.
Yeah, and I said, "You know, I want to do that." He's like, "Well, I've got to be honest with you. I've never heard Deliverance." He goes, "Do you have any of it on you, you know?" And I said, "No, I've got a demo of a new song I'm writing, though. I'll show you that." And it was Day of Execution. And so it was with a drum machine and just my 2 guitar riffs. And it was just ticka-ticka-da, ticka-ticka-da, ticka-da, ticka-ticka-da. You know, it was just all that. And
yeah.
I played it for him, and he just kind of stood quiet. And he goes, "Now put on that demo of that other, the Bowie stuff." And so I put it on, and he goes, "Why don't you mix both of those things together? Take your voice and put it to this heavy metal stuff." And I said, "Well, that's not going to work." And he says, "Well, of course it'll work." And he goes, "No, our fans, A, won't get it. B, I don't even think I get it. It's not going to work." And he says, "Trust me." And he goes, Let's do it." He goes, "When are you due to record another Deliverance record?" I said, "I'm writing for it now."
Yeah, now.
I go, "So I'm gonna probably go in the studio in about 3 months." And he goes, all right, I'll work out the details with Frontline. I'm like, hold on. I go, so where's my solo project? And he goes, we'll worry about that in time. And I'm like, okay. So I let them control what was happening, and we went in the studio and recorded the Stay album, and I was extremely happy. I was like, this is really cool. It's working. I think this is something really, really cool. And that began my relationship with Terry and Gene. You know, Gene hated me. That's the funniest thing, is Gene just couldn't stand me. And when Terry told me the story later, you know, because we all became such good friends later, but Terry said he called him before we were going to do that album, and said, hey, I've got a gig for us. You know, we're going to record the new Deliverance record. And he goes, oh, no, I'm not working with that guy. I can't stand him. And he's like,
did he know you from somewhere? Or
yeah, why?
Just the music?
No, I worked with Gene on Stay, on the Stay of Execution album.
Oh, you're saying after Stay. Okay, I see.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I didn't even think Gene hated me. And I was surprised to hear that.
Oh, man.
And what it was is, and I'll just say it, I grew up with, put it this way, I grew up in a household where every slang for every race and everything else was constant. My dad was almost like, basically like an Archie Bunker.
Okay.
Wow. I got you.
Except here's the kicker. My dad's a German Jew. Okay?
Wow.
And he married a Mexican, my mother.
Wow.
So he was like, all bets are off.
My point being, if anybody didn't have the right to talk like a bigot, it was my dad.
right.
But he did. And I'll tell you, I never even knew that we could just call black people because, you know, my dad always called them, you know, everything else. His favorite word was spook, but which I never understood. But here's the funny part. I'll never forget it. I was 9 years old, and he comes and he tells all of us, my army buddy's coming, and he's going to meet us, and this guy's like a brother to me, you know, and you guys be on your best behavior, whatever. And I'm talking, in walks in this 6'8" black dude. And my dad embraces him, hugs him, and they spend the whole night swapping army stories and all this other stuff. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, why does Dad talk like this when he's not prejudiced? Because I always figured that Dad was prejudiced, but that's really
it really, really just wasn't the case. It's just the way he talked.
Yeah.
Jimmy, I have a similar upbringing. My dad, not with us anymore. He was the same way. He used to, give you the shirt off his back and also make fun of you and your heritage as he's doing it. And it was like,
yeah.
You're confusing me as a child. I don't know what I'm supposed to say. So thank God I erred on the side of like, well, I'm not gonna call people like that. You know what I mean? But
you know what? I think. I think it was just the era they were brought up in. Probably. My father was born in 1926.
My dad was born in 1933. So yeah, it was backwoods stuff. You know.
Yeah. So I don't think they meant anything by it. I think it was just the way they spoke.
Sure, sure, yeah. And my parents, too, and they're a little younger, but yeah.
Well, by the time, I never had a filter, okay? So, I mean, that's one of the reasons the label didn't like me to do interviews. They didn't like me to, because I just never had a filter, and I always smoked, but when I turned 21, I started drinking. And, you know, they were just like, you can't do this stuff and be in a Christian band, and I said, why? You know, I'm not doing anything illegal. And yeah.
Let's circle back around to that. That's an interesting point. I always like talking about the era because I know how important everything became with appearance and shows and the way things come across later after the whole Tooth and Nail era hit and everything. It was like the Christian industry and that kind of thing. But
sure.
You're talking late 80s, like Vengeance and you guys, and I mean, did you bump into Tourniquet or anybody else out there? Like,
well, yeah, we were label mates with them.
So. Okay, were you guys booking Christian? Was it like Christian shows, like what it became, or were you guys just bouncing around with secular non-Christian bands? Did it matter? Did anybody give a shit? What was it like back then?
You know, I'll tell you. We always preferred playing with secular bands.
Okay.
And that was part of the tragedy that happened when we got involved in the Christian network, as it were, because now we weren't, you know, and of course, a lot of my views have changed over the years. But I will say, as where my state of mind was back then, we were very evangelical. And in other words, we were meant to go to the dark side and spread our message.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah.
So it made no sense to keep preaching to the sheep. You know what I mean? It never made sense for to have 99% Christians there, and I'm preaching little sermonettes for Christianettes, about sure, the lost.
Yeah. And, yeah, I never understood that either.
Right.
But it's what we were designed to do, and then by the time Weapons came out, I realized, you know what? We are so submerged. So I'm going to start writing stuff for the church because that's our audience now. Mm. And so that's why Weapons was a spiritual warfare Bible study put to music.
Mm-hmm. it totally is.
That's why, you know, Stay of Execution and Learn started touching on humanity and how I was feeling. And As a Christian, as a person of faith, I wanted to discuss my crises. I wanted to talk about, you know, I have problems with lust. I have problems with, you know, not being able to control my wang. I have problems with, you know, with this, that, and the other thing. And I wanted to talk openly about it. And I never was ashamed to.
Sure. Yeah.
I never was ashamed to admit my humanity. And
it's good.
You know, because I'm not Jesus, and I never claimed to be, and anybody that wants to paint a picture-perfect lifestyle of themselves, you know what, God bless you, you're more of a person than I am, I'm just me. Right. So, yeah. And that's the way I've always painted myself, and so, but like, back then, it was hard, and I was always known as the kid with no filter. I was always known, don't talk to Jimmy about this, that, and the other thing, you know, I mean, gosh, you know, everybody always said, you know, you can't ask Jimmy what he thinks of this band or that band because he's so rude and mean about it.
Because he's going to tell you.
But they knew I wasn't going to lie. Just because you were a Christian and a brother, I wasn't going to tell you you were great. I was going to tell you, you suck, you know?
It's funny you brought up Tourniquet, you know, because, you know, me and Ted were friendly. And you know, but Ted thinks of himself as Beethoven of the metal, you know, world.
I got that impression.
Yeah. And, you know, Ted would grade my records. I mean, you know, a first one, like when the first album came up, it came out, he called and gave it like a B. And would go through the whole 9 yards. I mean, the whole gambit.
Called you? Called you.
Yeah, he would call me.
The album's out, ring, ring, hey, Jimmy, it's Ted, I gave you a B, here's why.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck? Okay.
Well, so by the time Stay came out, you know, I pick up the phone, it's Ted, hey, what's going on, bud, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, I listened to Stay of Execution, and I've got to give you an A for effort and for blah, 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 but I'm giving you a D on this and that and everything. I'm like, so I let him tell me everything about it. And then I finally, at the end of the conversation, said, you know, Ted, I got to shoot straight with you. I hate everything Tourniquet's ever done. And I don't give two living shits what you think.
So, oh, my God.
I go, so stop grading my records, asshole. And I hung up on him.
Wow, that's great. Oh, yes. My word.
And that was me and Ted really haven't spoken since then.
I wonder what Ted got for Crawl to China.
Oh, who knows? I don't know. It seems like he gives himself an A+ every single time. So
whatever.
Yeah, that's funny, man. Oh man,
that is fantastic.
You must have got a
Eugene thing. I gotta finish that though.
Yeah, go for that. Yeah.
You thought I was a bigot because I would say stupid things when we were recording.
Okay, sure.
And he thought I was a racist, a bigot, a jerk, conceited, this, that, and the other thing. And Terry told him, no, it's kind of like his way of adjusting to be around people. He has to put on this Don Rickles routine. That's the way Terry described it.
Don Rickles.
Don Rickles.
Yeah.
That would be something he'd say with his era.
Oh yeah, totally. And Terry's like, you got to give him a chance. So
yeah, but everybody who doesn't love Don Rickles hates Don Rickles because they think he's an asshole.
Exactly. Yeah. I happen to love Don Rickles. So. Yeah, he's
fantastic.
Yeah.
But so I was watching my P's and Q's around Gene for the first like 2-3 weeks of recording, and then finally. I said, hey, let's go grab some lunch. And I told Terry to stay there and let me just take Gene. And so I went through everything with him, and we talked. And I told him, you know, I'm not the person you think I am. I go, it's just the way I grew up. And I go, so I don't mean anything when I make fun of you or when I make fun of other people. It's just my way. And I go, but you got to understand, I'm actually a caring, concerned person. I'm not, the asshole you think I am.
Yeah.
And we, after that, that broke the ice, and we became really, really good friends. And I got to be honest with you, I miss him to this day. I miss him.
Oh, yeah. Bad. Totally.
I'll
just say, just real quick before we move on, I wanted to say something about that. You know, when he passed away, as a person who was buying music that his influence was all over the place, all so many of the bands I was buying, nothing felt the same. Like, I don't say that in like a something you'd say at his funeral kind of way. I mean that literally. Like, right. his involvement with that part of the industry just completely changed things.
Oh,
people's music didn't sound the same. Records weren't produced the same. And you could literally feel his absence, like, just as a person who bought records, you know, CDs.
You know what? And he's hearing you say that right now, and he appreciates it. I believe that with all my heart, because Gene,
absolutely.
He was a genius behind the mixing console. Everything,
so good, yeah.
Everything I do, I credit to him. When people tell me, dude, your recordings sound tits, I'm like, thank you, Gene, because I learned from Gene.
Yeah, man.
And,
yeah, he was
So that makes me happy. That you know, I'm glad somebody appreciates what Gene did, because I know I did.
Oh, dude, absolutely.
Because Gene was just a genius. And working with him and Terry, I'm going to tell you, for me it was like working with Bowie and with Brian Eno. That's wow. What it was like.
Oh, yeah. I think they're just as like, you know, important. People may not know their names like they know Bowie and Eno, but I, you know, like I said, growing up and all the influences that all the people he recorded and, you know, Adam, again, just his own band, you know, like the stuff he played. I mean, gosh, incredible.
Oh, dude, yeah. It was great. I used to make fun of him and, you know, but we all made fun of each other, which was great.
Yeah.
But what really sealed the deal was I told this story to Terry. And, you know, it was funny because Terry never really believed what a huge Daniel Amos fan I was. And, you know, one day in the studio, we're doing the Learn album, and I pull out the acoustic and I start playing all the old Daniel Amos songs. And Terry's like, how do you know all these songs? I go, because I grew up on them. I love your stuff. I was never lying to you.
Because I told you.
So cool. After that cover, a horrendous disc, he wasn't convinced.
No, he wasn't. Wow. But by then he was. So then I tell the story of, I remember when you first hired Tim Chandler and he replaced Marty Dickmeyer. I was at that show. And... Wow. And he goes, really? He goes, over at Calvary Downing. I said, oh, yeah, I was there. And I go, and I'll never forget the look on your face, Terry, because that was the day Terry Taylor was no longer the heartthrob of Daniel Amos. And he goes, what? And Gene, at this point, his ears open, he wants to listen. Because Gene, a lot of people don't know this, but he was like me. He was a big follower of Terry and DA and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I tell the story. I go, yeah, you know, you went through the intros, you know, like you always do after a few songs, and you said, and you guys might see a new face up here. You know, Marty's no longer with us, but we'd like you to welcome, you know, Tim Chandler on bass guitar. And all these girls started hooting and hollering. And I go, and you looked over it that way like, I should have never hired you.
It's so awesome.
Harry got so mad at that story because he said, A, it wasn't true, and B, he says you're making all this crap up and blah, blah, blah. But Gene loved that story.
That's a great one.
Like, we would be hanging out, like, having Chinese food, and I'd be hanging out with the Lost Dogs, and which, by the way, I got to play bass at one show out in San Francisco with them because
their bass
player couldn't make it, so they asked me to fill in. And that was a dream.
Oh, my gosh. That's cool, man. That is rad.
We're sitting out having Chinese, and G goes, hey, how does that story go again when, you know, Tim first joined the band? Can you, like, say that, you know? And Terry goes, you know exactly what that story and how that stupidity goes. Like, you know, it's just interaction. Our friendship was one that I will cherish the rest of my life.
Oh, it's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a, you know, it's, you get that vibe from all those guys like Mike Rowe and, you know, the choir guys and all them. Like, you get a vibe that they're all like this big inside joke they all have together, and they're always jabbing each other, but it's all out of love, you know.
Oh, you know? Totally.
And so I could see sort of the respect of like, oh, he can carry his own weight now with our jokes and vibes and stuff like that.
Oh, it was so cool to be hanging out with all those guys, and like I said, to share a stage with them, it was just beyond brilliant, you know. And I just, like I said, I can't tell you how much it means to me. And you know, because Terry was my age right now when I started working with him, and you know, he saw me as such a young little pup. You know, I was 21, you know, 21 years old, and you know, he just saw me such like a little pup. But he was a huge influence. Huge, huge influence.
Yeah.
Jimmy, yeah. Dude, Steven figured all this stuff out as it was happening pre-internet. Like, Steven and I are cousins. And we used to spend holidays together. We live too far apart that we hung out on a regular basis, but we used to get together with him, and he would sit down and practically draw like the family tree roadmap for me and explain like Terry, Gene, Eugene, and he did all the liner notes. He knew,
it's all liner notes, yeah.
Yeah, he like he glued all this together for me because I'm too much. I just don't care. I don't feel like going that deep on anything, and he was like the leading expert for this entire frontline intense.
Oh yeah, awesome. Guys were just so good at what they did. Though the music was so good, mm-hmm. And I've never just been a strict metal guy. I love metal, but like that's one of the things I loved about what you did with the band was like mixing in all those other styles. And I mean, The Cure is one of my favorite bands. Peter Gabriel, all that stuff. I love it. And
Deliverance is cool because
he's an awesome guy, man.
Deliverance is cool because Steven was into all that. We're both into metal, definitely, but. Steven was into that side of it. He would be more of the Cure Kraftwerk guy, whereas I kind of came from the prog rock metal side of things, and you came crashing down on that Queensryche nerve so hard.
And I
was like, I feel like I'm listening to Queensryche and The Cure. This is cool. This is interesting. So I came from the proggy metal side of things, and I had to settle down towards that kind of stuff.
What's funny? I'm glad finally somebody mentions Queensryche because I don't know who does our Wikipedia page, but
dude, it's all like the Wikipedia page is basically like Jimmy Brown has such a hard on for Queensryche.
I know.
it's just like they're just like lyrical references, and they're like, here's another Queensryche song. I'm like, dude, he did more.
Who
than
did
just
it?
This.
This is funny. Hilarious. Some person.
But I do got to say, they were up until Mindcrime, they were like such a pinnacle influence to me. I absolutely adored them.
I liked Mindcrime. I loved Empire. And then they took that long period off at the time that I started to get more into like indie rock and stuff. Like I still liked my metal, but I was getting pickier about stuff, and I was finding DC hardcore and Discord Records and stuff like that. And then Queensryche came back with that
that Promised Land.
Oh, dude, what a piece of shit! Dude, Promised Land was terrible. I remember seeing the video, and the drummer was playing like a bunch of beer bottles and stuff, and I was like,
yeah, was weird.
I'm out. I can't do this anymore. Yeah. I'm so sorry I wasted so much time on all this prog stuff, because they just got goofy after a while.
Yeah.
Well, I really did love the, for me, it was Rage for Order and The Warning. Those records were just...
You were early Queensryche guy. I came in later. I came in around, isn't there one between Rage for Order and Mindcrime?
It goes the first EP, The Warning, Rage for Order, then I believe it goes right to Mindcrime.
Okay, then I think I came in something about Infrared. I Dream in Infrared? Where's
That's Rage for Order.
Okay, I came in on Rage for Order, so I missed The Warning and all that and everything, yeah.
Yeah, Rage for Order is a phenomenal record. I think it was so ahead of its time. And it was such a weird mix of metal and Prince and...
Yeah.
Oh, I love me some Prince, I'm not going to lie.
Oh, same here, dude. He's the black David Bowie for me.
Oh, yeah. Absolute black Bowie, for sure. I actually watch Purple Rain once a year.
He does. That's funny
you say that. I do too. I always make it a point to watch it once a year.
do you find it kind of comforting to watch it sort of around the holiday season?
I don't know about the holidays, but I definitely like watching it.
Yeah. For some reason, weird reason, it's like a time of the year that I like to watch that movie. I don't know why. It might have something to do with the fact that. He did the Batman soundtrack kind of similar timing,
I love the Batman soundtrack. As goofy as that is, I love that album.
He did the Batman soundtrack, and I got into the Batman movie around Christmas one year. I got it for VHS. I think just my brain just said Prince is like a wintertime guy. It's really weird, but Steven, that's cool that you listen to Prince. That's cool.
Steven seasonalizes everything. He's always talking about like, what's your favorite spring album? What's your favorite summer album?
And which Deliverance record do you listen to on Christmas?
Right, but I can tell when he's been on a Prince kick lately, because once in a while, Jimmy, when he calls me, he'll go, Brothers and Sisters.
Yeah, Dearly Beloved. Yeah.
Dearly Beloved, that's it.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Funny.
Awesome. Well, I got to transition. I would be crazy of us not to talk about the new record you did, because
of course.
And we could talk about Deliverance all freaking night, because like there's so many things to say about every one of your records. But
it's a history. It's definitely a trip around the world with talk about Deliverance. Yeah.
I mean, I have to quickly mention you guys are on record, in my opinion, as the best Stryper cover I've ever heard. The Surrender cover was. Dude. Like, unbelievably good.
Oh, thank you. Yeah,
and to think that was live in the studio is just
insane. You're the first person we can talk to about that. Can you tell us what the intense live series was like? Can you talk about that a little bit?
That was, speaking completely honestly about it, it was a big marketing ploy for Frontline.
It worked. I bought like 3 of them.
Yeah. It was a marketing ploy. They were, and what it was is they were trying to really introduce two new acts to the public real heavily, which was Rose and what was the other band?
Die Happy?
Not Die Happy. Mortal.
Mortal. I was just about to say that. Yeah.
Yeah, they were really trying to push their record sales because they weren't doing very well.
Okay.
And so they figured if they had Terry produce this entire series, and we were the guinea pig, we were the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And, they had us set up all live, all over the studio, and they just said, just play. And we're not going to do studio tricks. We're not going to do this, that, and the other thing. We're just going to, like you guys are rehearsing. And I said, well, that's a mistake, because I'm a clown, and all we'd like to do is just clown around. So, and dude, there's just hours and hours and hours of clowning around and edits and all this other crap that they had to cut out because we were just messing around so much, you know.
I love it though.
So was it pre-planned or was it literally like one day? Hey, just play live. We're gonna record it.
No, they just said come. They just said come in, and don't even. And Terry said don't choose your songs. Just you're gonna go ahead and just choose them off the bat.
So where'd the Stryper cover come from? You just decided to pull it out your ass?
No, we played that live as Deliverance for years.
That's awesome.
Okay, yeah, all right.
Yeah, since like 1986, 1987, we just that's still to this day my all time favorite Stryper song.
So. It's so good. It's so good. That might be my favorite Stryper album because of that song.
Soldiers.
I think Surrender is my favorite song.
Yeah,
Surrender is just a great metal song.
It's such a great album, and to me that was still when Michael wasn't traveling down the Dennis DeYoung route, you know. he,
still sounded like Michael Sweet to me, because now I hear him and I just hear Dennis DeYoung, you know? And I just, well, I mean, ever since the To Hell with the Devil and all that, you know, he just sounds so much like that. And he was definitely the pop guy of the band. I love
him. His vocals are fantastic.
He's a ridiculous, ridiculous singer. And
I'll
tell you, that's this is probably one of the funniest stories, and I got to throw this in there, and it's a quick one, I promise, because I'm a storyteller.
Yeah, man, go for it. Yeah.
The podcast is called As the Story Grows. You have the floor, dude. Let it rip. Who cares?
I've already known Mike and Bobby and Richard, and I never really got to know Tim, but I've known the other three cats for a while, and, you know, just, you know, you see them, you talk to them, you hang out. And now, this is right as Weapons era, you know, we're getting ready to record What a Joke, and my wife, I just finished a vocal track over at Pachyderm West, and I said, and she came and said, "You want to go to lunch?" I said, "I'd love to." And so I said, "Hey, there's this like yuppie joint down the street called the Burnt Tortilla. Let's go there." And we go in, and as we walk in, we're going to our table. I hear Jimmy Brown. And I turn around, and it's Michael. It's Michael Sweet, and he's there with some other guys.
Brad.
Well, now, my wife, A, had the hugest crush on Michael Sweet. Just thought he was, like, the sexiest man ever. And, you know, we walk over there, and she is just acting like a dork. And I say, "Hey, what's up, Mikey? How are you?" And, you know, we hug and, you know, and I talk. And I said, "What are you doing?" He's like, "Oh, I'm recording at the recording some tracks at blah, blah, blah." And I said, "Oh, I just got done recording over at Pachyderm West." And I go, "Well, yeah, we're going to sit down." I go, "Oh, by the way, this is my wife." And she was all shaky and dorky and, you know, and it was just hilarious, you know. And I said, "Well, it's good to see you, man." And we walk away. And we go sit down, and she goes, "Wow, he looks so different without makeup, you know? And because with the makeup, he looks like Boy George." And I started laughing. Which
is so true.
He does.
And she goes, "But without the makeup, he's like a very handsome man." And I said, "No, he's a good-looking guy, you know?" And then she's sitting there, and we're ordering, and the waitress comes, takes our order, and she goes, "Wait a minute." And I said, "What?" And she goes, "I just realized I acted really stupid over there." And I said, "No, you didn't. You acted starstruck. I mean, Michael's he's a star, you know. It's actually cool that I mean, it's no big deal." She goes, "No, but this star knew who you were and stopped you to talk to you."
Aww.
And she goes, I didn't realize I'm married to a rock star.
Nice.
I think that's an awesome story, man. That's sweet.
And I just thought, wow, that's so sweet of you.
That's so rad, man.
Me, I just like, whatever, let's eat. I appreciate it, you know.
Well, you know, it's like a genuine act of love to kind of like, you know, when you, those little details, you know, when people see that, like when my wife sees those types of things, and I think that's really a sweet story, actually.
Well, it's just,
it's really cool.
He's, it's funny, you know, we've been best friends since we were 12, and,
wow.
It's funny when you've known somebody all your life, you know, it's a trip, and she loves that I'm doing music, you know, because for 14 years I was in the casino industry, and
I wanted to talk about that. I was curious what that meant. Yeah.
And she just hated it. She hated who I'd become, and, you know, the suit wearing guy, and, you know, just the manager of, you know, and this, that, and the other thing, and she just loves that I'm back in the studio and I'm doing this. She goes, "Because you're just so happy." And
That's awesome.
It is really cool. And it's just funny, though, that you spend so much time and you don't realize, like, wow, I've known you over half my life. This is trippy.
Yeah.
Because I honestly, you know, until
you know, only in the morning when I wake up and I creak out of bed, I don't really realize I'm 46. I still feel like I'm 20.
Yeah, man.
I hear you. Yeah,
you've done so much for 46 years, though. I mean, we're not that far behind you. Trav's 40, you know, and I'm 37. But, I mean, like, for 46 years old, I mean, but you got started so young. I mean, some of the stuff you were doing at the age you were doing it, it's just crazy. Like, I could never think of playing the way you were playing at 18 or whatever. You know, it's just nuts.
Oh, dude.
Signing contracts at 15.
Well, that's what was funny is, you know, everybody laughs at those stories because, you know, back in at the Sunset Strip, you know, the Roxy, the Whiskey, the Gazzaris, the Troubadour, mm-hmm. all the clubs we played in Hollywood, up until I was 18, when we played those shows, I had to wait in the alley till it was time to perform because I wasn't allowed in there. I wasn't, you know, because I was underage.
Yeah,
so
totally.
I literally had to sit in the alley. Dude, after sound check.
I am so happy to hear you say this. I mean, you're Jimmy Brown from Deliverance. I went through the same thing when I was a kid, but it was playing cover songs in bars. I had to lie about my age to get in there. And, I remember playing like an Elton John song and whatever cover songs there were. And my bass player, who is the bass player in me and Steven's band. I play drums and Steven sings and plays guitar. We both lied about our age. He's a month younger than me, but he could grow a beard. So he was allowed to, like, stay in between songs. The bar waitress came straight over to me in between songs. She's like, "How old are you?" And I was like, 17. She made me sit outside. I remember he was sitting inside with a beer, yep. pointing and flipping me off. He was like,
that's awesome.
And I could see him. He could see me out the back door, and I was sitting on the curb, and they brought me a soda. I was sitting outside with a soda in between sets, and he's flipping me off from the bar. I was like, I'm going to kill him, man.
That's awesome. Yeah. that was me every show. It sucked. Yeah. Here's the worst part that I got to. I got used to never roadieing for myself, you know, because everybody lugged all their own gear, but I always had to have my gear lugged for me because I wasn't allowed on the stage.
We're in.
So I got
that's awesome. Hey, yeah, blessing in disguise. Wow, man, that was a really cool first part conversation. But we'll be returning for a second part, and we're going to be covering his new music with Jupiter 6 and some pretty intense personal stuff. And
we had to split this massive thing in half. This was a big one, but this Goliath-sized episode is totally worth it. I'm blown away. He said so many amazing, funny, cool things. This will be the last one before the holiday, too, so Merry Christmas.
Yeah, we're going to be doing a lot of audio in a very short period of time. So, all right, well, thanks for listening. We'll be back next time with more Jimmy P. Brown II.
We'll be right back. love you. Take care. Bye-bye.